On November 9th through the 11th, the Federal Society hosted the 2023 National Lawyers Convention in Washington, D.C. This year's theme was Originalism on the Ground, and it featured many excellent speeches, debates, and discussion panels covering a wide range of important legal and policy issues. This recording comes from that event, and we hope you enjoy it.
Good afternoon. My name is Matthew Hyman. I chair the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, and on behalf of that practice group, we're delighted to present today's panel. I've been given some instructions, which I intend to follow, so a couple of housekeeping notes before we begin. If you are interested in obtaining CLE credit for this panel, you are to scan one of the QR codes that are on the back of the program or on the placards, and then you are to scan it again when you leave today. That will give you a fighting chance with your bar of getting CLE credit. The second thing I want to note is that the practice group does programming like this throughout the year. We obviously, as the title of our practice group suggests, we're very much focused on international issues, whether it's international law, trade law, and national security issues such as FISA and law of war and a number of other topics. So if you're interested in the work of the practice group, you're interested in getting involved in a substantive way, we'd welcome your engagement. Please find me today. You can write a note to me or Jack Capizzi at the Federalist Society, and we'll get you plugged into the work the practice group does. So with that, it's my honor to introduce our moderator for today's panel, Judge Paul Mady. Judge Mady was appointed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in 2019. Prior to going onto the bench, Judge Mady was a partner at Lowenstein Sandler in New Jersey, where his practice focused on commercial litigation, criminal defense. Earlier in his career, he was a general counsel. He was a deputy chief counsel to Governor Chris Christie. And before that, he was an assistant United States attorney for the District of New Jersey. And with that, I will hand it over to Judge Mady.
Thank you. Thanks for the kind introduction and the opportunity to join the conversation today. I'm thrilled to be with a panel that really is going to need no introduction. Our topic for the convention, as we know, is originalism on the ground. Originalism, like textualism, is perhaps understood through the classical legal lens of the concepts of delegation and deference. We ask often where the separated powers of the federal government have come to rest by asking where they began, whether they have been appropriately shared, and when we can accept the reassignment of a task from one branch to another. That, of course, requires a ruler, and ours is well marked. On one side is history, that rich experience that influenced the founding era's understanding of our first law. On the other is texts, words that when read in the context of their ordinary public meaning when drafted provide a predictable means of informing our duties and constraining our discretion, a benefit surely to the judges, but to the citizens as well. These traditional tools, well, they are part of the qualities that have always been understood essential to any republic focused on the teleological goal of the blessings of liberty. Theory, of course, is shaped in the cool, calm confines of the classroom. Applying it on the ground, well, that's a bit harder. And when that ground is the battlefield, whether physical or virtual, domestic or foreign, challenges are sure to abound. Recall it was Madison who said, in war, the public treasures are to be unlocked, and it is the executive hand which is to dispense them. In war, the honors and emoluments of office are to be multiplied. In war, finally, the laurels that are to be gathered and the executive brow that they are to encircle. All of these puzzles come to rest for us in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, particularly the enigmatic Section 702. FISA was reauthorized as recently as January of 2018, and timely for our discussion today, will sunset at the end of the year, providing an opportunity for an exchange and opportunities for Congress to correct potential abuses, reconsider usefulness, and ask for necessary reforms. We are thrilled to have four experts in the field to lead us in that discussion. Let me introduce each of them very briefly right now. Their full biographies are, of course, available online, and we would be here all day if I actually tried to read them. So instead, I will simply introduce Professor John Yu, who is the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. Beth Williams, who's a board member of the U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. Jean Scher, who is a partner at Scher Jaffe and general counsel of the Project for Privacy, Surveillance, Accountability. And of course, Stuart Baker, who is counsel at Steptoe and Johnson. Each of our panelists will deliver opening remarks. We will then turn to what I know will be a lively exchange, leaving ample time for your questions at the end. With that, Professor, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Judge. Not a bad job from someone from New Jersey. I'm from Philadelphia, so
no one
told me I was going to be on a panel with someone from Jersey. But
we're going to make it work. We're not happy, but we'll make it work.
So it's wonderful to be here. Thanks to the Federal Society for inviting me. I come from the West Coast, where I'm happy to say for once, Stanford is much more anti-Semitic than Berkeley right now. We've had these terrible protests all around the country. And strangely, Berkeley, we have had relative peace and quiet. And although I disagree with them on many issues, I think our Dean Erwin Chemerinsky has done a good job protecting the right to free speech, but also making clear, and I agree with them on this, that the attacks in Israel were terrible, they were inhumane, and I don't think we should have a moral equivalency between what happened with the attacks in Israel and then Israel's right to defend itself and how it carries it out. But I just wanted to say that. I also want to say it's also my great pleasure to be here when we've welcomed to the Federal Society our first Italian chapter. And so I had the pleasure of introducing Eduardo Raffiota and Lorenzo Violini here. I hate to say this, Eduardo, but as you can see, we have to go to Italy now to get Leonard Leo's body doubles. The original source, as it were. But they're soon, I'm sure, to be the most popular chapter in the Federal Society as we all now move the annual convention to Milan from the Washington Hilton. Yes. But I'm going to get to Malcolm. Don't worry. We've got something for him. But actually, the reason I was going to mention John Malcolm, my favorite Civil War reenactor down here, is because it actually, this panel is one that I appeared on in November of 2001. I actually remember distinctly appearing, although back then the Federal Society was not this large and we did not have all the rooms of the Mayflower Hotel filled simultaneously, but we had a panel and it was about what are we going to do after the 9/11 attacks. And John and I were at the Justice Department in the days of those attacks and the weeks after. And I went back and read some of the things that we argued for and argued about back then. And they seemed to me remarkably unchanged in a way. And so I still think we have these fundamental differences to resolve about how to conduct foreign intelligence or counter-espionage surveillance and reconcile it with a Fourth Amendment due process approach to normal criminal law. I think the problem still for me is that if you're in war and we're in wartime, the president is the commander in chief, and part of conducting war successfully is to conduct what's called signals intelligence, is to conduct espionage and intelligence on the communications of the enemy. This is something that goes on to this day. In fact, I'm sure Beth is going to talk about this, but if you look at the, she didn't call it a dissent, I think of it as a dissenting opinion to the latest report of the Civil Liberties Board about the implementation of Section 702. It goes through a lot of examples, declassified, but still lots of examples of how this kind of surveillance has protected the national security of the United States in remarkable ways. I'm sure you can see it's being put to good use in Ukraine. I often ask actually my friends who are in favor of the idea that Congress has to declare war whether they support what Joe Biden's doing in Ukraine, where we give the Ukrainians the weapons, we give them the intelligence on what to shoot the weapons at. All we don't do is press the button on the missile. But it's clear that American intelligence is providing the Ukrainians with a lot of the tools for the successes that they've had. But that's all part of signals intelligence, which I think has traditionally been part of the commander-in-chief function and part of the, if not the core, of the executive power. The problem is that we tend to view after 9/11, but it's really after Nixon, but after 9/11 we tend to view the means that we're using to try to execute that function in a domestic criminal law lens, where we think, why can't this kind of surveillance be subject to the same constitutional scheme that we use to conduct essentially surveillance to catch people for committing criminal attacks? Right? Why can't we have a warrant requirement approved by a judge based on probable cause and apply that to surveillance we're doing for national security purposes? The one thing that's different, though, about 9/11, and by the way, that was the fundamental problem we tried to solve in the weeks and months after 9/11, when the program that became Section 702 first started. And I was the lawyer at the Justice Department who participated in standing that program up. So if anybody wants to ask any questions that I'm not going to answer, go ahead. But I was there, I saw its creation, and I worked on the very first legal opinions about it. And this is the same problem today that we thought about back then. But I think what's striking to me thinking about it now, right, 22 years later, is that the strategic situation for us is far worse. We are not just dealing with Al-Qaeda and the attacks on 9/11, terrible as they were. We are dealing with the revival of an axis that really has as its aim pulling down the American liberal world order. We're facing these kinds of challenges from China, Russia, and now Iran simultaneously, in Ukraine, of course, and now in the Hamas attacks in Israel, and then China's threats in the South China Sea and ultimately to Taiwan. And we're going to argue about minimization procedures when this kind of threat is rising against the United States. It reminds me, I hate to say it, of the United States' decision to stop warrantless surveillance in the period before World War I and World War II, where the Secretary of War at that time said, we're going to shut down our interception of potential enemy communications by telegraph and telephone because gentlemen do not read each other's mail. Right? That was the attitude we had through December 7th, 1941. You look at the kinds of debates we're having now about whether to reauthorize Section 702, where we're in a strategic situation, which to me is much worse than 9/11. I worry historians are going to look back at us now the way we look back at our leaders during the interwar period. So let me just say briefly why I think this conflict exists. I think presidential power and using intelligence wartime is fundamentally different than a criminal justice system, Fourth Amendment, due process, warrant approach in this one respect. The reason why the government is collecting this information is to try to stop future attacks. It has to do with what Judge Richard Posner called finding a needle in a haystack. That means you have to engage in a lot of guesswork. Right? You have to surveil lots of channels of communication because you don't already know the names of the people who might be spies, might be terrorists, might be enemy officers. In contrast, the Fourth Amendment process takes place when a crime has already happened, when the harm to the country has already occurred, and you're almost conducting an historical enterprise to find out who's accountable. So, right, that's why we can have these standards. Warrant application to a judge naming an individual with probable cause they committed crime because the crime has already happened. The need to do surveillance for national security purposes is future looking. You're not trying to hold anybody responsible or accountable in the legal system. You are just trying to identify threats and prevent them from happening. It involves a very different mindset, a very different kind of power than the kind that police and prosecutors traditionally use. So just very briefly, because my time has run out because of all the jokes I tell, which is why I'm usually on most panels. And then New Jersey, of course, provided a whole wealth of ones I didn't even anticipate. But 2 points to end. One is then, what's the Patriot Act? To me, the Patriot Act was a compromise that we made back in 2001 after the 9/11 attacks. Part of it was a political compromise. But another way to think of it is it created a safe harbor. Because the way we'd done national security surveillance before, if it's on the president's authority alone, that meant the president was solely and singularly accountable. And you think about what the FISA statute and the Patriot Act did, it created this weird mashup of all three branches now involved in national security searches. Almost doesn't hold the president accountable. Now you've got this made-up court that's involved with it that issues things that sound like warrants but are not Fourth Amendment warrants authorized by Congress. Right? It creates, basically what Congress offers and what the courts offers is to the executive branch, if you do your searches through the Patriot Act method, we're going to give it a kind of safe harbor treatment, and not just rely on you, the president, having to take responsibility alone for the way the searches are done. And then my last point is there are, of course, because of the abuses in the 2016 election with a Steele report. I say it all the time on TV, but I try to forget it. The Steele report or the abuses by the FBI to investigate President Trump for being an alleged Russian agent, you know, the Russia hoax. I think you see that, of course, in some conservatives' skepticism of the use of warrantless surveillance. But I would propose this at the end. It seems to me the problem is not conducting searches for national security purposes, which I think as a country we just have to do, or really the way we do it. I think the problem is the FBI. I think the real solution is to separate the FBI into two agencies. We are almost unique in the Western industrialized world by combining law enforcement on the one hand, and then counterintelligence, espionage, terrorism, and other, putting it into one agency. And I think some of the abuses are that we've allowed this domestic law enforcement agency, essentially a police agency, to have access to the kind of tools which I think should only be in the hands of the military and the intelligence agencies. So I'd say rather than try to figure out ways to reduce the scope of what we're doing to protect the country, to reduce the kinds of searches we're engaged in, I think the real problem is that the FBI has become too powerful, that we better to divide the agency into two parts, and they should not meet, and keep foreign intelligence and domestic law enforcement actually separate, rather than combining them into an all-powerful agency. And lastly, the proposals you're going to start hearing for, as Judge Mady said, the reauthorization of this, are going to come with conditions like, let's make the FBI even more powerful before we reauthorize. Let's have more layers of review. Let's have more bureaucracy. I think that's actually going to make the problem worse, not better. So thank you very much for bearing with me, and I look forward to the comments and questions.
Well, thank you for the introduction, Judge, and thank you to Matthew and the National Security Practice Group and the Federalist Society for the invitation to participate in today's panel. Before I discuss Section 702, just a brief word about the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which has the fantastic acronym of PCLOB, and the work that we've done. So we're a small agency created by statute in 2007 in response to a recommendation from the 9/11 Commission. Our statutory duty is to provide oversight of government counterterrorism programs and make recommendations for how to balance the protection of privacy and civil liberties with the needs of national security. There are 5 Senate-confirmed members of the board, currently 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. The board spent a year and a half investigating how the U.S. intelligence community uses its authority under Section 702. And in the course of the project, we received significant public input and numerous briefings and materials from the agencies that run the program and develop actionable intelligence from it. Although the report is a 3-2 report, and member Dizzino and I wrote a separate statement with different analysis and recommendations, 2 main points emerged from this investigation about which all 5 members agreed. First, the Section 702 program is highly valuable to the national security of the United States and provides irreplaceable intelligence. In 2022, almost two-thirds of the articles in the President's daily intelligence briefing, so arguably the most important high-level intelligence the United States has, contained information acquired through Section 702. Congress has to reauthorize this program, or American national security will suffer a disastrous blow. It is not at all an overstatement to say that lives depend on this program. The second thing we all agreed about, while all five members agreed that Section 702 is not a bulk collection program, we also agreed that reforms to the program are in order to fix some problems with its operation, particularly by the FBI, and to prevent its possible misuse for political or other improper purposes. This can be done without degrading the value of the program. As the board concluded, and as my colleague Rich Dizzino and I emphasize in our separate statement, Section 702 provides critical insights into some of the most urgent threats facing the country, including the proliferation of weapons to hostile nations and militant groups, cyber threats to critical infrastructure, the conflict in Ukraine, hostile state behavior, malicious cyber activity, including from China, Russia, and Iran, the trafficking of fentanyl across our borders, and the resurgence across the globe of hubs of terrorist activity focused against the United States. As the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, which is a separate organization from my own, stated earlier this year, not reauthorizing Section 702 would be, quote, one of the worst intelligence failures of our time. So while Section 702 is solely directed at foreign targets, it's also valuable for finding and stopping terrorist and foreign intelligence activity inside the United States. By collecting communications of foreign targets, it's possible to discover if those targets have associates in the United States or are talking about potential victims in the United States. And this is crucial, and I think it's overlooked. We learned from the September 11th attacks that all the foreign intelligence collection in the world is not worth much if the intelligence agencies can't connect the dots to find actual specific people who are threatening our national security. And the world, unfortunately, since then has not gotten safer, as Professor Yu was saying. The atrocities committed in Israel on October 7th are what a massive failure of intelligence looks like. We should not kid ourselves that we've defeated terrorism. Hence, personnel at the CIA, NSA, FBI, and National Counterterrorism Center may perform U.S. person queries of information collected under Section 702 in accordance with procedures reviewed and approved by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Any assertion that these queries are not valuable is demonstrably false. There's three reasons for that. First, queries are a quick preliminary step that help analysts to identify leads for further investigation. For example, if our military recovers on the battlefield the cell phone of a terrorist that contains a 212 New York area code, our intelligence community would likely seek to run that phone number in Section 702 acquired information to discover if it belongs to a U.S.-based contact of that terrorist. Second, queries allow the intelligence community to identify victims or potential victims. If foreign actors are targeting Americans for harm, it's important to know who they are targeting. With that knowledge, the IC can warn the potential victim and hopefully thwart or mitigate the attack. And this is especially true for cyber attacks. Finally, U.S. person queries are an efficient way for investigators to rule out inaccurate tips or leads. A U.S. person query that returns no results is still operationally valuable because it may eliminate further or more intrusive means of investigation, such as invasive physical or electronic searches or other electronic surveillance. There are a few mischaracterizations of U.S. person queries that should be addressed, and U.S. person queries are really what's being discussed in Congress today. I think most people are in agreement that Section 702 should be reauthorized, but a lot of the discussion is about U.S. person queries. So a few mischaracterizations of them. First, the number of queries that are being discussed refer not to actual persons, but to query terms or identifiers. What does that mean? Well, for example, an individual may use multiple selectors to communicate with a foreign target, for example, email, phone, etc. A single selector may be queried multiple times, or the U.S. person associated with the query term may not be a person at all, but maybe a company or association, not a specific American citizen. Indeed, in many cases involving cyber threats, the U.S. person query term is an inanimate object, such as critical infrastructure physically located in the United States, whose identifier is queried as part of an investigation. The number of U.S. person queries, therefore, are almost certainly greater than the number of actual U.S. persons whose identifiers have been searched. The second important misunderstanding is that a query does not authorize additional collection of U.S. person information. It does not authorize that. Queries are simply database inquiries of already collected lawful information. And when it comes to the FBI, the database itself is pretty small. The FBI has access to only a small fraction of the total Section 702 information collected, roughly 3.2%. And those are the ones that involve predicated national security investigations. Of that amount, U.S. person queries return content that the FBI personnel viewed in less than 2% of cases. That is to say, in 98% of the searches, no U.S. person communications are ever seen by the FBI. Having said that, significant reforms to Section 702 are in order, particularly with respect to how the FBI performs queries. In many cases, FBI personnel have not followed their own rules for querying Section 702 information, and there's no excuse for that. The American public deserves and must have confidence that its government follows the rules guarding against improper exercises of its authority. Even more troubling were the abuses leading to a national security investigation of President Trump and several of his associates. The surveillance in that case was conducted pursuant to court order under Title I of FISA, not Section 702, but it raised concerns about the Bureau's adherence to protocols and safeguards for the protection of privacy and civil liberties. This has to be fixed, and we can discuss a little bit more some of the recommendations that we have. But in closing, I'd like to emphasize that we can and must balance national security with protection of privacy and civil liberties in the operation of Section 702. Existing guardrails should be strengthened and new limits should be imposed by Congress to prevent the misuse of the authority. At the same time, failure to reauthorize the program or reauthorizing it in a way that would hobble the use of lawfully collected information would be devastating to our ability to protect the country. Thanks.
Well, I'd like to just follow up on Beth's comment that reforms of Section 702 are needed in order for it to be reauthorized, and maybe illustrate some of the reasons why that's so true. And let me begin with a question for the group. How many of us have ever donated to a political campaign, a congressional campaign specifically? Probably everybody in the room multiple times. Well, you may be glad to know, if you've ever done that, that according to a recent disclosure from the intelligence community, your contribution to that congressperson may well have resulted in the FBI's spying on you and 19,000 other contributors without a warrant using this massive database of information that's been collected pursuant to Section 702. And as Beth mentioned, is supposed to be focused on foreign threats and foreign persons. Recent disclosures also show that this database was used in 2021 to conduct 3.4 million warrantless searches of Americans' communications. And even after an effort by the FBI to shape up for this reauthorization debate in 2022, the FBI still used that database to conduct more than 200,000 such warrantless searches. And the FBI itself admits that at least 8,000 of those 200,000 searches were non-compliant with the FBI's own stated standards. And those included searches directed at least one Republican House member, a U.S. senator, a state senator, a judge, and a lot of people's girlfriends, and a lot of other people. And through this Section 702 database and through other means, today the executive branch conducts surveillance on our own citizens on a scale that would have been unimaginable to those who wrote and ratified Articles 1 and 2 of our Constitution, and who wrote and ratified the Fourth Amendment in the years between 1787 and 1791. And in that regard, I think it's important to distinguish between surveillance of foreign persons and surveillance of American citizens, which are on, I believe, a very, very different constitutional footing. But But the challenge that we have is that the modern surveillance state is directed in substantial part at American citizens and not foreign persons as well, but in substantial part against American citizens. And it's not just the Section 702 database. There are actually four broad categories of surveillance of Americans today in the U.S. Besides 702, a second type of surveillance is conducted under a different provision of FISA, which Beth mentioned earlier, Title I. That at least requires a warrant, and that's the authority that was later found to have been misused in the surveillance of several members of the Trump, who knows how many members of the Trump transition team in 2016, but including my client, Carter Page. And that provision nominally requires probable cause to believe that an American is acting as an agent of a foreign power, but it's been well established now that in the case of Carter Page, because of the present lack of any real adversarial process in the secret FISA court that was mentioned earlier, the FBI was able to get four warrants against Carter Page based on weak and to some extent even fabricated evidence that never would have passed muster in a normal court. The third mechanism for surveillance of U.S. citizens is Section 2.3 of Executive Order 12333, which is not based on any underlying statute, but it allows the intelligence community to spy on Americans' texts and emails and browsing history and anything else stored in the cloud, again without a warrant. And the fourth mechanism, which currently is completely unregulated, is government purchases of our data. And these purchases allow spying on Americans' most sensitive information of all kinds, including our location, our internet activity, and again, all without a warrant. Well, fortunately, the upcoming expiration of Section 702 provides an opportunity for Congress to reconsider and, I hope, rein in this entire massive multi-pronged system for spying on our fellow citizens. As you can imagine, the FBI and other elements of the intelligence community are demanding what they call a clean reauthorization with no added guardrails of Section 702 or any of these other three systems of surveillance. But fortunately, as far as I can tell, just as there is zero support in Beth's agency, PCLOB, for a clean reauthorization of Section 702, as far as I can tell, there is zero support in Congress for a clean reauthorization of that authority. And so the real question at this point is this. If Section 702 is reauthorized, what are the conditions or the protections that should accompany that reauthorization? The organization that I represent and a number of other organizations on the political right and left and center believe that Section 702 should, in fact, be reauthorized and for many of the reasons that have been discussed already, but that it should be done in a way that respects four specific principles. Number one, any surveillance of Americans should be undertaken only pursuant to a statute enacted by the people's representatives in the Article I branch, and not through executive orders or any other kind of self-appointed authority by an executive agency. Number two, Congress should recognize that Americans have a legitimate expectation of privacy in any electronic data that they have taken reasonable steps to protect, including password protection. And absent a genuine emergency and consistent with the Fourth Amendment, any government-related searches of our data that we've made an effort to protect should be undertaken only under the authority of a probable cause warrant. People in the intelligence community worry about whether that would be too burdensome. But if you take Beth's example of a phone found on a battlefield that has a 212 number in it, if the FBI goes to a court and asks for a warrant to do a search for that 212 number, they're going to get a warrant in an instant. And So I think the concerns about the difficulty of the warrant requirement are vastly overblown. And of course, we operate with warrants in many aspects of our legal system anyway. Number three is that agencies should not be allowed to buy their way around the Fourth Amendment and other legitimate privacy protections by getting our personal information from data brokers. And number four, any surveillance of Americans should be subject to real oversight by Congress and the judiciary, thereby ensuring accountability for the exercise of whatever authorities are granted to the executive branch to surveil our own citizens. Fortunately, a substantial bipartisan bicameral group of senators and congressmen just this week have introduced a bill that, in my view, satisfies all of these four principles. It's called the Government Surveillance Reform Act, and it's co-sponsored in the Senate by none other than our own beloved Senator Mike Lee on the Republican side, and by Senator Ron Wyden on the Democratic side, and several other senators in both parties. And in the House, where the bill has also been introduced, it's co-sponsored by House Judiciary Subcommittee Chair Andy Biggs and other prominent members of the House Freedom Caucus, along with several members of the House Progressive Caucus and a number of other more centrist House members. In fact, as you all know, it's rare to see such a wide variety of people on all parts of the political spectrum agreeing on something like this. If it passes, the GSRA will, I think, rein in our ballooning surveillance system in several ways. Number one, it will generally prohibit warrantless searches through any of the four mechanisms that I've mentioned earlier of Americans' personal information, including phone information, text and email communications, geolocation, web browsing, and internet search history. Now, the bill has reasonable exceptions for genuine emergencies, such as identifying malicious software and truly serious imminent threats. In addition, this bill will fully phase out surveillance under a provision of the Patriot Act that is almost dead. You remember the Princess Bride? It's called Section 215 of the Patriot Act, and it is almost dead, but it's not quite dead. And the GSRA will completely phase it out, and so that it can't come back to life. And that's a provision that gives the government warrantless access to business records, like all of our emails, stored at Google or or wherever, and any documents that we may have stored in the cloud on our Google Drive or Microsoft OneDrive or anything like that. Section 215 allows warrantless access to those materials in certain circumstances. This legislation will also require the appointment of civil liberties experts or amici to assist the secret FISA court in testing warrant requests in sensitive cases like the Carter Page case, and having gotten deeply into Carter Page's case now as his appellate counsel, I am virtually certain that the shenanigans that plagued the Carter Page investigation would not have happened if the people at the FBI had realized that there was a significant risk that somebody was going to catch them in the FISA court, and having an independent person there sort of advocating for privacy generally, I think would have deterred the kind of misconduct that we saw there and that has now been widely recognized. The legislation will also hold officials in the FBI and other intelligence agencies accountable for negligent or willful violations of the new legislation or FISA or other authorities, including, in egregious cases, firing them and stripping them of their security clearances. And one of the things that I've learned as I've talked to a lot of people about this issue is that what typically the thing that FBI agents most fear if they get caught doing something inappropriate, is that they would lose their security clearance, because that means they can no longer go to the private sector and make four or five times what they're making working for the government. And so, you know, in order to have real accountability, you need to put people's security clearances at risk. Just to close, the GSRA already enjoys widespread bipartisan support because, in my view, it's the most balanced and comprehensive surveillance reform in 45 years. And perhaps most important, given the theme of our conference, if it passes, it will make major strides towards realigning the federal government's surveillance powers with the founders' vision of what our government should be. Oh, thank you.
So one of the things that I learned when I started out working for senior people in my law firm, and they started telling me about the evils of the Smoot-Hawley tariff and the like, and I thought, God, this guy is really old, and he's given us all this history. And I realized that once you get to a certain age, nobody actually knows what you really remember and what you just heard about from your grandparents. So I thought I would talk a little bit about the decision to let the Japanese communications go untapped. No, I'm not going to do that. There you go. I actually am going to talk a little bit about my history in this. Because I think you're going to be there too, sooner or later. It'll tell you why I'm here and why I'm saying the things that I'm saying. I joined the intelligence community in the 90s when I went to work as general counsel of the National Security Agency. And the 90s were a time that is surprisingly similar to the times we face now. That is to say, there were a lot of congressional Democrats who were pretty skeptical of the national security state and national security agencies and surveillance, and always up for a little more restriction on them. And then there was a growing, by the end of the 90s, there was a growing group of Freedom Caucus Republicans who were equally skeptical and enthusiastic about reining in the law enforcement and national security agencies. And that created a phenomenon that we sort of see now, a sort of ratchet that you could get something that restricted what the intelligence agencies did through Congress. Wasn't always easy, but you could do it. But if it didn't work out, you were never going to repeal it, because the folks who didn't support the decision to the people who were opposed to the national security state were always eager to find a reason to leave in place the restrictions that had been put there before. And so we had this slowly ratcheting set of restrictions that was just generated by the political times. And the beneficiary of that ratchet was something called the wall between law enforcement and intelligence, which you may have heard of. The wall came out of an idea that was, you know, a kind of a good idea in the abstract, right? We had all of these really incredible capabilities to do surveillance that we were using against other nation states that were, you know, existential threats to the country, and we were glad to have them. And then the question was, well, should we use them against criminals in the United States? And the thought was, well, that's really overkill. We're going to end up with a police state in which all of these surveillance tools are used against Americans routinely. Let's put a wall between what we do for national security and what we do for law enforcement. And it kind of made sense. I was at NSA, and it made sense to us, too, because we were a little afraid that if the Justice Department started using all these intelligence tools, they would sooner or later want to go to court and brag about them in open court about what they had done. And that we didn't want to see. So we sort of said, yeah, let's have a wall. That's a good idea. And what happened, thanks to the ratchet, is gradually that wall got higher and higher, And by the end of the 90s and into 2000, 2001, the FISA court had taken over the enforcement of the wall, had required every agent that came to the court to swear that they were observing the wall, and they would always observe the wall, and they hadn't breached the wall. And just as today, the notion was, well, we have to make sure that we have enforced these restrictions. And the FISA court caught an agent who had let some information slide across the wall about national security. And the judge said, this person must never appear in federal court again to testify. He's unreliable. This is the end of his career, for sure. And maybe we should be thinking about a perjury prosecution for having signed this assurance that he was going to be observing the wall. That's where things stood in the summer of 2001. Also in the summer of 2001, we knew that Al-Qaeda was planning a big attack on the United States or its allies. We didn't know where, we didn't know when, we just knew it was coming. And at that point, the CIA discovered that some of Al-Qaeda's worst actors were already in the United States. They wanted to tell the FBI, because the CIA doesn't look for people in the United States. You need the FBI and their law enforcement authorities and their big task force to go looking for those guys. And when they said, well, we want to tell them about that, the FBI general counsel said, are you kidding? That's the end of your career, too. You can't do that. That's a violation of the wall. And to their credit, the people who wanted to make that report screamed bloody murder. They said, this rule is only helping terrorists, and it's going to kill somebody soon. They were nonetheless told, you are not going to provide that information. You can take your intelligence resources in the FBI, you know, the two men and a dog that worked at the FBI in intelligence at the time, and see if you can find them. And they were still looking 2 weeks later when all of them slammed into the World Trade Center. So we had weeks to find those guys, and we didn't find them because we had adopted a rule that sounded like a perfectly good rule. Oh, you know, good for civil liberties. Why not? They can work around that, but they couldn't. Finally, the enforcement of that rule drove the FBI to say, okay, if that's what you want, that's what you're going to get, and that's what we got. I had to live with the consequence of having said good things about the wall. Prior to that, I ended up testifying to the 9/11 Commission. And, you know, it's deeply, profoundly disturbing to have to say I supported this. This is a question that will come to you, too. If the restrictions that are being proposed on 702 work out as badly as I fear they will in the world we live in, we're going to find ourselves with cleaning up after a major terrorist event and asking ourselves, why did we think this was a good idea? So I'm going to suggest there's plenty of reasons to reform the intelligence community, but there are need to be two rules. One, you got to be responding to an actual abuse that you can identify and whose cure you can identify. And then second, the cure has got to be such that it doesn't wreck the intelligence capabilities that we need to protect ourselves in a world that is more dangerous now than it has been in the last 20 years. I don't think that the standards, especially the requirement for getting a warrant to do a search that the FBI today does by going in and typing in a name, meets that requirement. It would not kill the program. It would just drown it in paper. It would be 10 times the paperwork load that currently is being carried in doing FISA applications, and that load is enormous. And the purpose of it would be to say, we want to make it harder to find out whether Americans are talking to intelligence terrorism targets outside the United States. We want to make sure we've made that as hard and as paperwork intensive as possible. I'm just not sure that that makes sense, and I don't know what problem we are solving. We heard a lot about the possibility that the FBI was looking at donations and officials to see whether they were in the database. But many of those were efforts to find out whether they were being watched for an attack or otherwise under surveillance by international figures. There is almost no case, despite all the innuendo in this area, where you can say, yeah, those millions of searches, I found 50 of them where the only explanation is malice or partisan bias. It's just very hard to find actual cases where partisan bias occurred. And if you wanted to stop partisan bias, going to the FISA court is the last place you would go. I mean, first, they, you know, put aside what they did on 9/11, they had four opportunities to review the Carter Page affidavits, which were demonstrably flawed from the start. And by the fourth one, which was June of 2017, anybody who read the newspapers, even the New York Times, would know that there was a problem with the Steele dossier and the data that was being used to support the Carter Page affidavit. And what did the FISA court do? Bupkis. They just sat there and let it happen. So why are we thinking they're going to be a protection against the misuse of this authority? They're just going to be rubber stamping the stuff. They have a constituency. The constituency more or less inhabits the faculty lounges of the top 20 law schools in America, and that's who they respond to. They're not ever going to stand up for Trumpistas who are under investigation. So that's, I don't understand why we think that's a solution. I don't understand why we have hundreds of other ideas, just kind of, hey, this is, what, isn't this a good idea too? Well, you know, just like the wall was a good idea, sounds good. That's not a reason to do it. We have to say we saw an abuse and this is how we're fixing it in the most targeted possible way. There are plenty of abuses that need to be fixed. Many of them we saw in the last 5-7 years. But we can fix all of them with targeted solutions, not by saying, why don't we think of as many possible ways to make life hard for the people who are doing this intelligence collection as possible.
So let's begin our discussion with a topic that I have a passing interest in, which is the role of the courts. I hear some to say that the answer is Article III judges, that these are warrants like any other warrants. They can be reviewed for probable cause. The burden and inefficiency will be light, and the protection of liberties strong. I hear others to say there is no comparison between the kinds of warrants that would be necessary for predictive crimes as opposed to retrospective investigations, and the idea that judges are capable of doing this in the time necessary to help an investigation is fanciful. How do we resolve this tension then without sort of getting right to the big question, which is what is the nature of the Article II power to begin with? Because it seems as though, at least as I'm hearing it, where you come out on the nature of executive authority here sort of resolves the question of what kind of process that's needed. And I imagine there are varying viewpoints on that answer. Welcome your thoughts.
Well, I'm happy to start if you like. Like John, I have some experience, and Beth, I have some experience working in the executive branch. I was an associate White House counsel under the first President Bush, and I don't think I take a backseat to anybody with respect to presidential power to conduct military affairs and foreign affairs. But I don't see anything in Article II that gives the president the authority to surveil American citizens. I think that authority is properly lodged in Congress, and to the extent that American citizens are going to be subject to surveillance, that's something that Congress needs to decide. And they need, you know, if there's a good case for authorizing the executive branch to engage in that, then they should do that, and they have in some limited cases. And I, you know, with respect to the warrant requirement, I've read analyses from a number of ex-members of the intelligence community and the Justice Department who say, you know, it would not really be that big a problem to seek a warrant if there's good reason to search the 702 database for information about American citizens, that in fact it would not be that big a job to do that. We have prosecutors seek warrants all the time. It's typically not a terribly burdensome process, and if we don't think the FISA court is up to the task, then another option is to have ordinary Article III courts do that as appropriate. But if we're going to depart from the from Fourth Amendment standards, there ought to be a very good, compelling reason to do that, and otherwise, I think we ought to follow what the Fourth Amendment says.
Can I respond to that? So just a few points of information. So first, I think it's important to know that no court has actually ever held that it's a Fourth Amendment requirement in order to conduct a U.S. person query. No court has held that. Second, look, 702 has nothing to do with surveilling Americans. And what the unanimous Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board said in 2014, and some of us have, you know, re-emphasized recently, is that if you wanted to conduct a domestic spying tool, if you wanted to put one together, 702 would be a truly terrible way to do it, because everybody who's targeted under Section 702 has to be a foreign person overseas. So to the extent that American communications get caught up in that, it's if you happen to be emailing with a foreign target, which means if they want to surveil you, the only thing that they're getting in the 702 database is your one end of your communications with the foreign target. If they then see, oh, that guy who's communicating with the foreign target might be a terrorist too, but he's either in the United States or he's a U.S. person, then they have to go and get a warrant. So it's not surveillance. The only people they're allowed to target are foreigners overseas. And the intelligence community has actually had a really, really good compliance rate with regard to collection. They're over 99% compliant, which means that they're not inadvertently targeting Americans, which is actually a great improvement from where it was in 2014, because we had this thing called abouts collection, which means the technology wasn't great and more Americans were accidentally getting swept in. That's been taken care of, so that's a really good thing. The other thing I wanted to just quickly address is, Professor, you suggested about 702 being used for law enforcement, because if it were, that would be a big problem. And that's one of the things the board looked at. And what the board found, both in the majority report and in our report, states it's not being used for law enforcement. It's not. There are zero prosecutions that have come out of Section 702 information. And that's a good thing. That means they're not using this foreign intelligence tool to try to find tax evaders and then using it in tax cases or other things. So I think that that's another positive. There's no evidence that we saw, at least, that they're misusing it for law enforcement purposes.
Do you want to go, Stuart? Yeah. I think there's two different aspects to your question, Judge. So one is, what should Article III courts do? And that's in a way separate from what should the Article II understanding be. Because I would say judges, of course, they don't have to listen to the executive branch at all. You have the power to reject the use of any evidence that comes out of any of this in any criminal case in your court. And that's, as you can see, the Article III role as being defensive. Right? You don't have to rely on another branch. But in the course of conducting your own constitutional functions, right, you interpret the Constitution and you feel that the evidence that's collected in this way is not done in a constitutional manner, then you can exclude it. I don't know, and this is part of the problem that arose with Stuart's talking about with the FISA court, is this: if you drag the courts into it through FISA and the Patriot Act, you had FISA courts sort of managing the way we were doing electronic communication surveillance before 9/11 and after. In I think, in a way that was well outside the judicial function. It almost was like management of the executive branch. And that's what some of the criticisms of the 9/11 Commission report were. But I think that's different than, you know, Article 2, how do we understand it? That's just what you as a judge could do. I think with Article 2, I don't mean to imply that Gene takes a backseat to anybody on the war power, how far it goes. It does seem to me that the Constitution gives the President the Commander-in-Chief power, and we have traditionally understood that power to include the authority to collect intelligence as well as to use force. In a way, ideally, the better intelligence you have, the less force you have to use, right? The better signals intelligence you have, the less destruction you're going to have to use to get your targets. I don't think that the Constitution creates a different rule of war based on whether, unfortunately, some of our enemies include U.S. citizens or not, or whether people are acting on U.S. soil or not. I think that's the way we think about it because it's easy to sort of understand what we're doing within the United States or with U.S. persons as being governed by a law enforcement framework. But, and again, this is stuff we thought about right at, after 9/11. The Civil War, under Abraham Lincoln's theory of the war, everyone we were fighting was still an American citizen, right? Every member of the Confederacy was still a citizen. Lincoln had to grapple with this problem too. Do the laws of war, the right to use force, signals intelligence apply in the same way, even though we were still fighting other Americans? And Lincoln decided, no, that we're going to use the normal methods of war, even though unfortunately we were fighting citizens. This also kind of came up in World War II because there were Americans who went back to Japan and Germany and joined the enemy forces, and the Supreme Court had to decide, does being an American citizen mean that you still are treated by the criminal justice system, even if you're fighting against us? And the Supreme Court said no, that, you know, you're going to use the normal rules of war, that being an American citizen fighting against us doesn't give you a kind of immunity or right to a different level of treatment once you take that step of joining up or fighting against us. So I just, there's some hypotheticals, and these were unfortunately what we were worried about. Stuart was in the government too. Well, you weren't still in the government.
Not yet.
You had just left. But these were the kind of things we were worried about at the time. Suppose, and this happened in Mumbai years later, suppose you had a roving grand group of terrorists with weapons going through an American city. Are you still going to use the Fourth Amendment to try to gather the intelligence to try to stop them? What if you thought that there was a nuclear weapon or some other kind of large explosive device being hidden in an American city? Are you going to still use a warrant requirement and the Fourth Amendment? And then I just say, again, I think the current situation we are in is actually, this problem is magnified because now it's possible because of the internet, because of hacking, because of new technologies, for people to inflict huge amounts of damage on us without, on American soil, solely using communications technologies. So it seems to me it makes the case for actually expanding the authority of the executive branch to try to use and to try to intercept electronic communications rather than reduce it.
So I will only make this observation. I promised I would tell you about 1941, and now I will. In fact, Congress had passed the Federal Communications Act in the 30s and made it illegal to intercept radio communications. So it was just a flat violation of law to intercept those communications. But in the run-up to December 7, the Army Chief of Staff, George Marshall at the time, said, no, forget that, we're going to do it. And so he actually authorized intercepts in violation of federal law. Then after 9/11, 702 was adopted directly contrary to all of the requirements of FISA. FISA said, this is the only way you're going to do this, and you're going to have to go to the FISA court and collect this information. And the president said, nope, we're going to violate that rule. The rule of law as it applies to intelligence is kind of 0-2 in terms of coming to the right conclusion. In both cases, the right decision was the one reached by the executive branch to say, we're just not going to accept these limitations because they're existential. And, you know, maybe we've got one more strike in us, but it does seem to me that the longer we go and the more we pile. Anybody here read Thidwick, the a big-hearted moose, where the moose just keeps letting more and more animals move into his antlers?
That was from 1941, too.
Yeah, exactly. my mother read it to me. We just load more and more things onto a service and a capability we have to survive future conflicts. And at some point, it just collapses, and we say, that whole idea was a bad idea. I'm not comfortable saying, oh, we should just violate these laws, but that sure looks like the judgment of history.
Gene, I want to pivot back to you and add this question, because I've heard this a couple times now, that this is all sort of too much theoretical concerns and not enough on-the-ground consideration. And I know you've offered a different perspective on that, so in addition to other thoughts, if you could sort of touch upon, how much of a concrete concern are the intrusions of liberties that you're seeing?
Well, I think what we know from the disclosures from the intelligence community is very significant. I mean, the fact that they would do database searches, whether you call that surveillance or not, and I consider it surveillance, but whether you want to call it surveillance or not, reviewing a massive database with lots of information on people, and choosing as your selector, people who contributed to a congressional campaign, or doing searches for a particular congressman or senator, there are lots of examples where people have run searches just because they want to get more information about an ex-girlfriend or something like that. It seems to me that's a very concrete example of an intrusion into liberty. We don't know exactly what those communications show, but people have lots of confidential communications with others, and anytime you have government reviewing your communications with somebody else, that's a cause for concern. And I just like to respond briefly to Stuart's point. It seems to me Stuart's whole argument here proves way too much. It seems to me the implication of his argument is that Congress just has to take the FBI's word for it. If the FBI says, we really need this authority and we really need it not to have any guardrails on it, that Congress is just supposed to take their word for it. And I think the message of the last several years is, can you really trust what the FBI says? I think they're certainly on Capitol Hill, trust for the FBI is very low in both parties.
And, so they don't have to just take it, but they should stop lying about it. Let's be candid about this. When they say these are searches spying on Americans, 99% of those searches were checks that came back, there's nothing here. That is not spying on people. That's a check to see whether there's a communication here. And frankly, I kind of would want to know if people who are contributing to campaigns are also in touch with foreign terrorist suspects. That's a valuable piece of information, and I'm glad that the FBI cares about that. So to call that spying, when all they were really doing is to say, I wonder if this person is tied up in this particular database, I do think you're stretching espionage well beyond what anybody would actually call it. And I would say that more than 99% of what the FBI was doing was what the FBI usually does. They have a database, they want to know is somebody in that database, and then they want to find out if it is, what's going on inside that. And the idea that that is spying, if 20 people are going to meet with the president, and the FBI is not checking to see whether they are any of them is talking to a foreign terrorist suspect, the FBI is not doing its job. And yet, you know, the Gene's position is they ought to get a warrant before they do that, and they can't get a warrant because they don't have probable cause to believe these people are talking to a foreign terrorist. That's what they want to know. And I think we, frankly, should be a little more careful about calling that illegal espionage when it is, in fact, a simple vetting of people who are participating in dangerous activities that could turn out to be dangerous.
Well, the whole question is what should be legal, and Congress is going to have to decide how far that authority goes. And my understanding of the system is that not every communication in that database is communications of U.S. persons with foreign terrorists or anything like that. And in fact, if that were true, the FBI could not have admitted recently that, you know, that of the 200,000 searches it did in 2021 or 2022, I guess it was 2022, that, you know, that 8,000 of them were contrary to the FBI's own guidelines.
Yeah, the FBI adopted those guidelines because they were crammed down their throat by the Justice Department, and the Justice Department said the standard is you have to have reason to believe that there's foreign intelligence that will be derived from this search. Now, you got 20 people going in to meet the president, and you want to know whether any of them have been talking to foreign terrorists. Do you have reason to believe they have? And of course you don't. Do you have reason to believe that they're going to be in the 702 database? No, you don't. So you violated the rule, and the rule is nuts.
Okay. So propose to Senators Lee and Wyden that they include an exception for people who are going in to see the president. I'm sure they'll be happy to have that.
But
the answer is not. We just let the FBI do whatever they want.
So only slightly less unpopular than the FBI in this panel, as I can take it, is the FISA court. And I'm sort of wondering, is the FISA court then just irrelevant to future solutions? Is it something that can be reformed? Will anyone speak up for it? Or is it an idea whose time has come to pass?
I mean, I'll take that. So the FISA court serves an important function. They review Title I orders, and they oversee the whole Section 702 program, including all of the certifications. They review the program every year and annually certify all of the procedures. So they serve an important role. But I don't think anybody would say, let's just let the FBI monitor themselves and that's fine. There are serious problems with the FBI. And one of the recommendations that my co-member and I suggested is that there actually needs to be more congressional oversight, because the FISA court is a poor vehicle for doing the type of oversight of the potential political misuse of intelligence authorities that a lot of people are worried about. If you're worried that the FBI is going to go after political actors or associates of political actors that the FBI agents don't like, you know, that may be a valid worry. Is the solution to then have the FISA court check it, or is maybe the solution for the sensitive terms that are used every 6 months, every quarter, to actually go to Congress, to people who are going to look at it really closely, not necessarily with a legal lens, is this, you know, agent of a foreign power, or does this satisfy whatever legal standard Congress decides upon, but is this political misuse of an intelligence authority? There's ways to have effective interbranch oversight over some of these issues without necessarily going to the FISA court.
And just before you respond, I just want to say we have time for some questions shortly. So if we do, if you want to take one of the microphones, and we'll get to you right after the professor's response.
It's not really a response to Beth. She describes what the FISA court does quite accurately, which is approve different rules and procedures and different search mechanisms. But I want to repeat criticism of FISA that Judge Silberman had when he testified against FISA back in the 70s, and he recently passed away. I was a clerk of his, so I, of course, required to read everything the guy ever wrote, and I came across his testimony against the Constitution on FISA. I think Robert Bork also testified along these lines, which is, how is this role, no matter how important it might be to give us assurance about what the FBI is doing, how is this consistent with the Article III court's authority to decide cases or controversies? how is it a case or controversy to approve a search program and the rules and so on? It seems, and this is what really were, and you go back and read their testimony, it was actually really interesting. They predicted this would actually draw the federal courts out of their constitutional role and get them too involved with foreign intelligence searches. And I really think this is what happened, and it will blur the accountability, therefore. So if you think about how the intelligence searches were done before FISA, the executive branch did them, as we've heard. The president did them on his or her own authority. So FDR, right, his administration, decides to breach the Electronic Communications Act back from 34. Right, LBJ, JFK, a lot of them did this. And then they're solely accountable for the decisions, right? They are responsible politically for any mistakes that are made. They can't blame the FISA court, right? They can't blame Congress. And I think we should ask, is it actually a better system than one we have here, where we have this kind of, again, this weird court, which is not deciding cases or controversies, but reaching outside them to sort of make management decisions, sort of blessing all of this. And then when their mistakes are made with Carter Page, undeniable that what happened to Carter Page was a violation, why don't we think about the president, right, who authorized those, being responsible? Instead, we get into the arguments about FISA courts and so on. That's the very blurring of accountability which the separation of powers is assigned to defeat.
Yeah, thank you. Ed Hurst, out of the San Francisco Bay Area. I wanted to follow up on a comment that Professor Yu made with respect to separating things out, and I wanted to get the panel's comments on that. Perhaps taking the FBI's counterintelligence division and counterterrorism efforts that relate to overseas and having it report to the DNI. Maybe that's the benefit of taking domestic politics out of it somewhat, and also taking out the fact that they can use these advanced tools to even for domestic law enforcement. And so I wanted to get people's thoughts on maybe having counterintelligence and anti-terrorism report to the DNI instead of FBI overall and DOJ. Thank you.
It was my idea, so I shouldn't say how great it is again.
You're welcome.
Well, look, I mean, I think Stuart made a great point before, which is that I think the solution should be tailored to the problem. So if you see that the FBI is using these intelligence tools for law enforcement purposes, that's a problem. That's not something we've seen, at least in our analysis of this. Prosecutions are not coming out of these intelligence tools. If there were, I would agree that that would be a problem, and that might be a consideration.
Is it accurate that most of the abuses that the report talks about occur in the FBI, though? It's not the CIA or the NSA that are, Gene mentioned 100,000, 200,000 kind of searches that weren't supposed to happen. But these are all, so that's my point. It's not that the FBI is actually taking this and using it for prosecution, which would be a serious problem, like that would be crossing, red line, but it's that the mindset of the FBI is that you've combined the counterintelligence and law enforcement functions, and so you have people who are thinking in this confused manner, and so they think, oh, I've got this database, I can just sort of check it. They're not thinking like a counterintelligence agency would do, because they are within part of this domestic law enforcement operation.
I mean, look, the FBI is very decentralized. It's not like the NSA. It's very decentralized. That has advantages and disadvantages. I think there are mission advantages to the way it is. But one disadvantage is that you've got agents all over in branch offices who don't have, necessarily great training and who I think need to have a better mindset. So we have a lot of recommendations for how to improve it so that these tools are used properly, so you're not doing an improper search.
I'll give myself the final question then. One of the fascinating things going back to the topic of our week here is, when we look at this from an originalist lens, I wonder the panel's thoughts on whether it's appropriate to even ask these seemingly 20th century questions, let alone 19th and 18th century questions, in what is now a 21st century problem. We talked about the Patriot Act, the horrors of 9/11. These all pale against the threats that we now see, given consolidations of information and the idea that we now live in a digital as opposed to analog world. is that an argument for the status quo, or is it an argument for greater congressional vigor in this area to examine what has to be, and I welcome your thoughts, an entire shift in the landscape of the kinds of threats that now exist against the United States?
Could I maybe answer with a thought experiment? Imagine that we could bring James Madison back and, you know, and let him watch for a year or so what's happening with our intelligence system, and explain to him the history and the background and all of that. I think if he were to see what, and I talked earlier about four different sort of programs, four different ways that the FBI is engaged in surveillance or analysis of Americans' communications and that sort of thing, I think he would be horrified by it, both as a matter of his understanding of the Fourth Amendment and of his understanding of the proper allocation of power between Section 1 and Section 2 branches. I think he would say, there are probably some efficiencies in allowing the executive branch to do this on its own without meaningful oversight from either the judicial branch or from Congress, but we decided in the way we set up the government that we were going to accept some inefficiencies as the price of freedom, and we did that in the structure of the Constitution, and we did that in many of the amendments that we passed to the Constitution, and that we ought. I think his recommendation would be we ought to go back to that model.
So if I could pick up on what are the threats that we're looking at now, everybody in this room has had their fill of predictions about artificial intelligence and where it's going and what it's going to mean. But the consensus is it's going to empower a lot of people. Even if it doesn't decide to do it on its own, it's going to empower pretty much anybody who wants to develop brand new, much more toxic poisons, much more infectious diseases to do so on their own, without a lot of help. That means that we will all survive at the sufferance of every single other person on the globe. It is not possible, most people would say, to build the artificial intelligence so that it won't do that. We've already seen plenty of jailbreaks of artificial intelligence, and that's almost certainly an inherent feature of AI as it's being designed today. So when you ask people who worry about that, what do we do about that? The only answer they have is we need to do a better job of surveillance of who's doing what with these tools and how they are developing the things that are made possible by the tools. It's not a question of can we accept some inefficiencies in doing that. The question is how many deaths do you accept before you say we need to do a better job of surveillance? I don't love the world that implies. But I don't think James Madison would come back and say, you're just going to have to live in my world and suffer 21st century consequences. It's not a good situation, but the fact is we are being pushed by increasing capabilities in the hands of irresponsible people toward ever greater surveillance, because without that, sooner or later, these weapons of mass destruction are going to be deployed by, disgruntled teenagers.
Taking Gene's thought experiment, we don't have to make it a thought experiment. We can ask, how did President Madison do in the War of 1812? He took these attitudes towards, and we almost lost, right? It was just because General Jackson beat the British that we survived as a country. I'd rather have Alexander Hamilton in charge if we're going to be defending the country. I'm happy to have Madison govern us for domestic, right, policy, but I think it's a different mindset, and that's what I was trying to get at, again, because of 9/11 put us to have to think of this in this way, is the Madisonian system, a balanced, balanced powers, overlapping checks and balances, does not work when you're talking about external threats to the country's safety and security, And I think the framers were aware of this. Right? This is why we have those parts of the Federalist Papers that Hamilton wrote that talk about energy in the executive and the ability to act with swiftness and secrecy and speed, because those are things you need, the qualities a president needs to have to defend against external threats. And there are going to be errors. I mean, part of the way maybe to understand this panel is how do you deal with the fact that you know you're going to make mistakes? And so in the context of new technology, do we feel so confident that we are in command of all the costs and benefits of different rules, that we want to impose these pre-existing rules rather than using maybe a standard that we use after the fact to think of damages maybe as a remedy, rather than saying, we're just never going to do this ever as kind of a blanket rule-based system? I think in the kind of uncertainty that judges talked about, we want to have a standard base that's going to say, let's use the technologies first, and then afterwards, if there are abuses and mistakes, we'll figure out some kind of damages remedy for those harmed. Like Carter Page, I think, should get a lot of money from the government. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do foreign surveillance anymore. That's a rule basis I think is unwise in a period of uncertainty.
I would just say, look, I go back to the Constitution. We don't have to, it doesn't have to be a thought experiment. The Fourth Amendment doesn't say there shall be no searches and seizures. It says there shall be no unreasonable searches and seizures. And I think that was very purposeful. And so it's up to, you know, I think Congress should be interpreting that. They should be thinking about what is the appropriate balance. You know, we've tried to do that in our organizations, and I know, you know, Professor Yu and others have tried to do that, but that's the question. It was not a bright line. It understood that some things will be reasonable, and we need to consider that, you know, in the context that we're in.
And speaking of technology, this is the last panel of the day, so if you're pursuing CLE, please make sure to scan the QR code on the back of the flyer. I want to thank all of the members of this exceptional panel for this discussion tonight.
What are you talking about here?